Traguna, Macoides, Precorum, Satis D.
Nothing happened.
Am I doing something wrong?
Well, to tell you the truth, it does seem a bit old-fashioned. After all, we are in the 20th century.
What do you suggest?
Well, it needs rhythm, tempo, music. As I always say, do it with a flair. Do you mind if I have a go?
Oh, of course not.
Now come along, you lot. We need all the help we can get.
Traguna,
Macoides, Tricorum, Satis D. Traguna, Macoides, Tricorum, Satis D.
Tricorum, Satis D. Macoides, the air is a commotion, mystic with power that's far beyond the wildest notion. It's so weird, so clear, yet wonderful to see. Substitutionary locomotion, come to me.
Shh!
Traguna, Macoides, Tricorum, Satis D.
Traguna, Macoides, and Tricorum, Satis D.
I don't want no commotiary substitution or emote in transitory convolution. Only one precise solution is the key. Substitutionary locomotion, it must be. Traguna, Macoides, and Tricorum, Satis D.
Hello, and welcome to Book vs. Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
Well, we are getting to the... Do we have one more week of November? Are we counting one more week, or are we switching? This is it. Okay.
This is it.
So we are wrapping up our very first All Disney November. This may become an annual thing because there's certainly plenty of Disney movies and nearly all of them have been adapted from books or literary sources of one kind or another. But if you're new, yeah, as the name suggests, we are a podcast about movies that have been adapted from books. But since we've been in this pandemic time, we've been doing a brand new episode every single week. That means sometimes we're using shorter literary sources, could be a children's book, could be a magazine article, could be a song. Today, though, we are going to be talking about Bedknobs and Broomsticks. In this case, it's going to be two books. But if you would like to make suggestions for next month's episodes, we're still looking for ideas for holiday episodes. There's several places where you can do that or interact with us or other listeners of this podcast on the internet.
We do have a basic Facebook page. A lot of people like that page because all the episodes are posted there, and it's an easy way to leave us some feedback or leave us your ideas. Also, we have a private Facebook group, and that's really where we're much more interactive and where people are interactive with one another with ideas. And so you just type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group and ask to join. It's a private group, and really we just talk about books and movies there. We are on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movie. You just spell all the words out there. And we have an old-timey email, bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can send your request suggestions there. Also, if you would like some stickers, or we have a couple of bookmarks left, we can drop them in the mail for you. You could show your love for the show by slapping that on your laptop or whatever.
And if you really, you know, one of the things about the show, if you are thinking of making suggestions for future episodes, we do have a couple of ground rules. And number one, it should be something that is very easy for anybody to get their hands on. We certainly don't want to be spending loads of money on books and movies. We don't want you spending lots of money on books and movies. So we often, you know, we really try to make sure that we get things that you can get from your library, you can get on the Libby app, or that perhaps you can easily get on Amazon or stream, you know, find a way to find the movie, you know, without having to shell out too much dough. But if you would like to help us to keep paying for books and movies and serving costs and all that sort of thing, you can support us on Patreon.
Yes, we have been doing this show for 7 years now, and we are putting all of our episodes from 2019 and then previous to that are going up on the Patreon wall. We have a new Patreon this week. Patron, excuse me. His name is Sean, or her name is Sean. I'm sorry. It's a one of those gender neutral names. Thank you, Sean, for signing up. And we have, like I said, the last few years, we have some great episodes. I just put up Breakfast at Tiffany's is up there. Before that, the old episodes, they're all free. There's a bunch of free stuff there too. So if you don't want to spend the money or you just want to check it out for yourself, go and check it out. It's P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and just look up book vs movie podcast. And I also forgot to mention, going back to the stickers and the bookmarks, we also have a bunch of magnets. So if you want to put something on your fridge, we got really cool magnets. So reach out to us if you would like that. And once again, Sean, thank you so much for supporting the show.
Yes, thank you, Sean. Today's books, I was really excited to read. I don't know that I've ever read them before. Had you ever read them before?
No.
I have read The Borrowers. I loved The Borrowers when I was a kid. I absolutely loved those books. But I had never read Bedknobs and Broomsticks. This is the first time I ever learned that it's the same author, Mary Norton.
Our author today, Margot, is Kathleen Mary Pearson. She was born December 10th, 1903 in London, England. She is mostly known for the Borrowers series. I've never read those books. I didn't even know what they were about.
Oh, they're wonderful. And I think they hold up. You can definitely still send them if you're looking for like a great book for like a, I would say 8 to 11-year-old.
They would love that. It's about tiny people living in the walls of a home. Oh, that sounds amazing.
It's the story of like, you know, when you're like, I know I left this pen right here. Where did it go?
Oh.
Or where did I put that spare button? You know, it's a story about what happens to all of the little bits and bobs and ephemera of your life that just seem to vanish into thin air. Where do those things go?
And she picked a particular house in London, or in England, excuse me, that was the model for those stories. She also wrote The Magic Bedknob, or, comma, How to Become a Witch in 10 Easy Lessons. She also wrote Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And the thing is that she wrote the first book in 1945. She's also somebody that survived London and the Blitz, emigrated to America for a while. And she writes these stories about these children. We've talked about this many, many times about how much the Blitz affected Londoners and affected the English and
a number of books that we've done, right?
Yes.
I can just think of a bunch off the top of my head, that potato peel pie,
yep.
Potato peel pie one, the Oaks, Cold Comfort Farm.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that we did that where the kids got evacuated. Anyway, it's a thing that comes up. Oh, when we talked about The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
And the birds.
Yes, and the birds as well. So I can imagine if you were, first of all, I mean, anybody who had to live during the Blitz, that would just be a massive event in your life that you kind of would be taking the rest of your life to process, let alone if you were a kid who had to be evacuated away from your, I can't even imagine how scary that was. And they did it more than once. They had to evacuate them more than once.
It was several years of this kind of terror. And Margot and I, we didn't know each other then, but we both lived in New York on 9/11 when there was a terrorist attack here. I mean, these people dealt with it over and over again for 4 years. I mean, I don't either, but there's a lot of artists like this is how they got their work out. They kind of, you know, they sort of process it in this way. What happens is she has two books that are basically about the same story, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. There's two different books. And Walt Disney had purchased the rights to Mary Poppins. And he was having issues with the writer for Mary Poppins. And we talked about in our Mary Poppins episode. I think that's on the Patreon wall, by the way. It might even be for free. And there's a whole movie about it, about how P.L. Travers was not happy with the changes Walt Disney was going to make. And
it was like 20 years, right? Before he got her to relent.
It was 20 years
working on that movie.
Yeah, there were like 5 or 6 Mary Poppins books by that time.
But Walt is a smart businessman. And so naturally, he had a backup plan in case Mary Poppins never happened. And his backup plan was Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Right. And they were working on them in the early 60s at around the same time. And he had the Sherman brothers on. And we've talked about Richard and Robert Sherman as well before. These are these gifted songwriters that just know how to write catchy tunes. But it's very similar stories. It's about kids that are, you know, either they're orphaned or they're lost a mother. They've lost a parent.
It's similar fantasy elements. I would say both characters, both of the main characters, Miss Price in Bedknobs and Broomsticks and Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins, they have like a magical element, but they're also quite stern with the children. They're not like warm, cuddly, fuzzy ladies. They're kind of independent minded. They're not married. Yeah, they do. There's a lot of similarities between the two main characters.
And they figured Mary Poppins is the more popular one, and that's the one he really wanted to do. So Julie Andrews became associated with that. And then they would start with Bedknobs and Broomsticks and then put it to the side. And the 60s is a kind of a strange time for Disney. They started going more towards, you know, live action films. Walt was getting older. His brother was getting older. It just their ideas and the things that they used to put into for films. You know, the 70s are different. It's a whole other thing. They finally get around to this and they sign Angela Lansbury to the story. And then it was open to mixed reviews. And then it became later a classic. It's one of those movies that was like Fantasia.
People didn't get it right away.
They did not get it. They thought it was weird and trippy. They just didn't understand like why any kid would like this. And then turns out every like almost 10 years or so, they would keep re-releasing it and new kids would find it. And kids love it because it's weird and different. That's kind of part of the
charm. It's kind of the thing about it. Yeah. I was saying last week, you know, when we were talking about doing this, that this was a movie that really scared me when I was a kid. And I don't know if you, I was trying to think like why this was a thing in my neighborhood. And I think, I don't know if this is something that you experienced as a kid in the late 70s. I'm curious about this. I lived in a neighborhood with a lot of military families. So a lot of my kind of neighborhood playmates were military kids, different branches. San Diego has like all the branches of the military. And there was this fad in the late 70s for kids' birthday parties. You know, kids' birthday parties go through these like trends, right? And there was this fad for about a couple of years there where every single kid's birthday party there was a part of the birthday party where we would watch movies like with a projector on a big screen. Like the parents would have this huge screen that they would roll up and a real, like for real to real movie projector. And it was always the same movies at every single party. We would watch Ricky Tikki Tavi. There would be a short. There was a short that we always would watch about that song, I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly. And there was like a whole animated thing about that. And then the feature film was sometimes it was Willy Wonka and sometimes it was Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And so I saw it several times, you know, when I was probably 7, 8, 9 years old. And it really scared me. And now watching it as an adult, I think what scared me about it was how dark it is. It's a very dark, just visually very dark movie. Not that the themes are particularly, I mean, they're somewhat dark, but just it's very, you know, where Mary Poppins is bright and sunshiny and they're in the park and they're flying the kite and the beautiful blue sky. This is very dark and sooty and mostly takes place at night for some reason.
or day for night.
And so I think for that reason, it kind of unsettled me as a kid, but it's, I just, you know, spoiler alert, I really liked it. I thought it was great.
And you and I were talking back and forth as we do during the week. You were saying how much you enjoyed this book and I was about the halfway mark and I was enjoying it too, but I super enjoyed the second half of the book when they go back in time. I was like,
really cool. So this is a thing. Well, let's talk about the book.
Yeah.
First of all, one of the things just right off the bat that I love about the book. So the book is written during, like she's writing contemporary, you know, she's to her time. She is literally writing during World War II when the evacuations are actually happening. She's right in the middle of it. And the story never says that there's a war on. The story, I don't think, directly mentions the war ever. I don't think it ever does. But it does say that it's like today, like it's happening today. And, you know, so you're, if you're reading it in the mid, in the early 40s, you're like, okay, so the war is happening. And it just says something like the children are suddenly sent away from London to visit an aunt. I think at first it's an aunt right out in the, out in the country, but you don't really say why, but everybody knows why. Anybody who's reading it at the time understands why that's happening. So in the book, their mother at least is alive still, but she has to stay behind in London. The children are sent to the country to live with an aunt who is not in the book for very long. She's older. She's very fussy. She's not delighted about having the kids stay with her. And while they're staying with her, they're up late at night. And the young, is it the youngest one that sees Miss Price?
I think it's the youngest one. He notices a woman that he saw in town named Miss Price, Eglantine, right? Eglantine. But she rides a broom in the middle of the sky. And he kind of gets...
And not very well.
And not well. And she's falling off and she's just learning how to do this. He and his siblings basically find out about Miss Price. They realize she basically spills the dirt that, you know, I'm an apprentice witch and I am out to fight bad guys. You know, I'm learning how this witchcraft in order to fight these bad guys that are making England, you know...
It's, right. Again, she never directly says Nazis.
No.
And that nobody ever says... Or fascist or the Blitz or anything political. I mean, it's very aimed at kids, which I really appreciate. And I thought, you know, again, I've never read this book before, but knowing what I know from what we've covered, you know, in the past, as we just said, we've done several books about the Blitz, several books about the evacuation of the kids. And I really appreciated that, you know, she's writing for a child audience. She's probably writing for kids who are in the middle of being evacuated themselves, right? Who are missing their moms and dads and who maybe don't understand what's going on. And so she doesn't ever, you know, I think to spare them, she doesn't really go into, oh, there's big scary Nazis coming to like bomb London into oblivion where your mom and dad is.
Right.
You know? So she's very careful with her, and yet you get the sense of, they know that there's a danger. They know that they have to leave. They're sad about it. Everybody seems to, you know, the adults are sort of talking in these vague terms. Yeah, she wants to help. Miss Price wants to help. So she's, you know, she's using her talent or the little affinity that she has for this thing to get as good as she can so that she can be of service.
To England.
Yeah, to England. But it doesn't get any more specific than that, which I think is really nice.
Yeah, they meet her. She's going one day and she twists her ankle. That's her broomstick ankle or whatever. But the kids walk her home and then they tell the cranky old lady about her. And the cranky woman says, oh, bring her some peaches. That'll cheer her up. And so they all walk over and they become friends with her. And so that's how they all become friends. And then eventually this woman is learning as an apprentice. She's learning by mail. She gets these catalogs and letters. She's in a school to learn to be a witch. And she makes this magic bed knob. And for the youngest, the kids are missing London like crazy. They just cannot... the country's boring to them. They miss their mom. Like there's just nothing going on. They don't understand because they don't understand what's really happening in the world. Miss Price gives them this bed knob and instructs, you know, if you turn it to the left, you can go wherever you want in the world. If you turn it to the right, you can go back in time, but you can't go forward in time. There's a whole thing about that. But they go to London first in the book and it's just the kids.
Yeah. They're like, okay, we can go anywhere we want to go. And this is not in the movie. So this whole part is not, a lot of this is not in the movie at all.
Right.
The movie is much more blatant about like, it's World War II. There's bombings happening. We got to get the kids out of here. There are Nazis. I mean, I really was so moved that they're like, okay, you can go literally anywhere in the world, anywhere your little teeny little heart desires. You could go to, you know, you could go to fly yourself to a candy factory in the middle of the night.
You go to the South Pole or the North Pole and meet Santa.
Anywhere you want. And yeah. They're like, and the little boy's like, I just miss our mom. Yeah. I just miss mom. Please take me to mom. And the older kids sort of are trying to dissuade him because they understand that there is a danger there, that they're not supposed to be in London. But they go, but they also can't help it. They miss their mom so much. Yeah. And so they go to they make the bed take them to London. And I really loved this whole sequence too, because again, you're imagining that kids are reading this who are going through this exact experience themselves. And yes, of course, that's what they would want to do. Of course they would, if they could magically transport themselves, that's what they would do, is transport themselves back to London. But when they get to London, first of all, they magically appear on a brass bed in the middle of the street. That's weird. But everyone who, all the adults, it's only adults there, right? So all the adults who come by are like, whoa, kids are here. Why are kids here? Kids, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. You know, it's not safe for you to be here. We need to make sure you get back to where you belong. Their mom isn't home. You know, their mom could be anywhere. People were being moved and shuffled all over the place. I mean, during the Blitz, people were having to go down into the subway, you know, it was very dangerous. And so eventually they never get to their mom, but they eventually get taken to the police. Right.
Right.
And they get taken to the police, and the police are trying to figure out what to do. Everybody's trying to work out, like, we got to get these kids out of here because it isn't safe. But again, she does it in a way that I think if I were a kid reading it and I was going through that experience, I would understand, like, oh, you know, this is for my own good. I'm not supposed to be in London. And what if I went back and my mom couldn't find me, you know? And I think she explains just enough, but without making it too scary for children, without causing them to worry about their parents.
Right.
Too much, as I'm sure they must have been. Anyway, I just thought it was so beautifully done. And yeah. then the police are very funny. Like, there's a lot of bumbling with the police.
In the bed and the kids.
In the bed. And yeah. So eventually they get back to the bed and they magic themselves back. And they're like, okay, so London was a bad idea.
Right. And she just starts to learn new tricks, and she tries new tricks on them. And there's the back and forth. And I super enjoyed the second half of the book that I read. I think it's the 1947 version I read. So Miss Price, there's a fella who she is friendly with, who's a witch. He's a warlock, I guess we would say. I don't know. But they are not really boyfriend, girlfriend, but they have common interests.
No. Yes. So... unlike in the movie, the bed, and we should say, there is a scene where they go to this cannibal island.
Yes.
It's a little cringy. Yeah. Not in the best taste. But
no. With the savages.
But eventually, yeah. But the kids' shenanigans because of this, and they go in the middle of the night, so they're all tired the next day. And their aunt that they're staying with is like, I can't deal with this. This is too much for me. I'm an old lady. You got to find someplace else to stay. And so eventually they end up staying with Miss Price. But unlike in the movie, like, the bed can go anywhere. It can even go back in time.
Right.
And so they decide, okay, well, let's go back to London, but let's go before all of this mess. And they go back to London a week before the Great Fire of 1666.
Right.
And there they meet a man named Emilius Brown in the book? Emilius Brown. So he's Emilius Brown, and he is basically a wizard?
Maybe a wizard.
Or except he's somebody who has studied, what do they call that? Alchemy. He's studying alchemy. He's like an apprentice to an elder wizard. And right about the time that the kids show up, the elder wizard says, takes them aside and is like, listen, this is all bull crap. We don't actually do magic. We just tell people that we do, and we make a very nice living. And now this business belongs to you, Emilius Brown. And Emilius is like, what? My whole life was a lie. And, but then, you know, then these children show up by magic. And so he's like, well, maybe magic is real. And so they get this relationship. And so the whole second book, they have brought him back into the 20th century. So they pulled him out of London 1 week before the Great Fire.
Right.
And now the second book all takes place in the 20th century during World War II. And he is, so he's this kind of Englishman who is living in now in World War II era England and learning all like the crazy 20th century. He's like amazed at the radio and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's really sweet.
It is. He's very sweet. He does go back in time, but by the time he comes back, the fires have happened. And then they find his old shop and they are like, oh, he must have done it because he was doing all these weird experiments. And so he gets rounded up in like the witch trials. He's going to be burned at the stake. And the kids figure this out and they take Miss Price with them and they go back in time. She just rescues him at the very last second. And she's on her broomstick, like flying in to like poke him off the stake. And it scares the people away. And that's when they figure like, oh, maybe he is a magician. Huh? And then he and Miss Price have this conversation and they want to be together. And it's like, do we stay here or does he come to the future? And they decide it's best for them to go back in the past. And she even makes a point of like, well, we're going to have indoor plumbing because I am not going back.
She's like, I'm cool with everything. The indoor plumbing has got to come with us because this
yes.
is, yeah, the outhouse is not the biz.
No. And that's how they end it. And it's so charming and it's really, really
it's
sweet.
Lovely. Yeah. So they go, in other words, to the children, Miss Price, you know, when she leaves them, she's dead. She's been dead for centuries. They only have their memories of her. They can only go to the place where they know that she and Emilius lived and to feel close to the, and anyway, it's lovely. So again, it ends on this note of when people leave you, you know, when they leave this world, that connection to them isn't broken, which is such a lovely,
you have their memories,
you know, message for kids for that time. It's beautiful. I really loved the book.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
Yeah. And funny. Very,
very funny. It's got a great sense of humor.
And so we go along and it's now the 60s. They've had Jungle Book. They've had a few. The Aristocats was really popular. And here comes
Sleeping Beauty.
Sleeping Beauty, which we talked about. That's early 60s.
And also, this is after things like Hogan's Heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, our cultural handling of that era is evolving.
Well, The Producers by Mel Brooks is a key part of that. We have our Hitler. That's my favorite comedy line. Anywhere. We bring back to the show Angela Lansbury, whom we just both adore. They approached, of course, Julie Andrews first, because if it's a musical and it's got kids in it, you got to ask Julie Andrews first. You got to make money.
Understandably. I get that. I get it. She was
awesome.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah. She wasn't digging it too much. She's like, oh, this is just too much like Mary Poppins. I want to. And then she changed her mind because she thought maybe it's going to make a lot of money. And she came back. And by then they already had Angela Lansbury. Should we play the trailer? Okay. Here's the trailer. 1971, Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yay!
What is going on here?
Soon, you'll see a world of magic beyond anything you've ever seen before. It's Bedknobs and Broomsticks from Walt Disney Productions.
Who's digging in here? Who will defend every inch of England?
To help England fight off an impending invasion, an apprentice witch goes to war with centuries-old empty armor.
Any on the left?
Bedknobs and Broomsticks, starring the incomparable Angela Lansbury.
My first broom.
As Miss Eglantine Price, who takes a correspondence course in witchcraft. And David Tomlinson. As Professor Emilius Brown, a lovable London con man.
I've been cheated.
On the road,
and three homeless Cockney waifs who alone can help Eglantine find the missing spell. Their search is supersonic. Their adventures are ultra-fantastic.
Sailor, for some reason, we have great difficulty finding referees round here.
Perogee.
And her magic is enchanting.
Oh, Charlie!
It's grand. When you're dancing on the
See sand, Angela Lansbury
bopping along, singing a song on the boat.
In Walt Disney Productions' most magical motion picture, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. It's family entertainment.
The director is Robert Stevenson, and the screenplay is by Bill Walsh, Don DeGrady. And I thought they did a decent job of taking the material and making something linear with it.
They couldn't do it the way that you do it in the book. I mean, I understand, of course, you can't go back in time and just the budget. They already spent so much on the effects. I mean, you have to understand too, these effects were state of the art.
They won an Academy Award. The one award they won was for the special effects.
Yeah. But, a couple of things, you know, about the movie is that they cut half an hour off of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of story got cut out of the final version simply because Walt wanted to premiere it at the Radio City Music Hall, and you couldn't have something longer than 2 hours.
Because there was a whole show with it.
Yes, you got the movie plus the Rockettes, and so the movies couldn't be that long. Oh, we should say also that this is the last movie that Walt Disney actually worked on mm-hmm. himself. He died, I think, before it came out, but he so this is the last one he worked on. It's also the last movie that the Sherman Brothers did for Disney, partly because they cut so many of their wonderful songs. They were like, this is enough of this. And so they walked for quite a while. I thought it was so good. I really liked it. I liked the cast is excellent. Mm-hmm. I think what they did with the story makes sense. By this time, you know, the kids who would have lived during the Blitz are almost 30.
Yeah.
You know, so it's probably their kids watching it. And yeah, I think all the way around, it's a pretty solid effort.
They really lean into World War II. And as you said, we were talking about it now. It's been 25, 30 years. So people were ready to have the conversation about Nazis and just calling them Nazis. And this is when Nazis were bad, by the way. It wasn't even a question mark.
Yeah, remember that? You could actually say Nazis are bad, like in a movie, and people would go watch it.
Yeah. And that's what's going on here. She's fighting. I started laughing because it's her broomstick when she's trying to ride. And Angela Lansbury's so funny in this movie when she's trying to ride the broomstick and she keeps falling.
You know, one of the things, again, I'm just going to gush about Angela Lansbury one more time because I just love her so much. And one of the things that we haven't talked about that she is so gifted at is physical comedy. Angela Lansbury is such a gifted physical comedian. I mean, just extraordinarily so. And like if you've ever seen it, not that this is a comedy role, but in Sweeney Todd.
Yes.
I mean, her physicality of that character is all of the levity of the whole thing is just encapsulated in that one character and her amazing skills as a physical comedian. Yeah, she's brilliant when she's trying to like you really buy it. Like, you don't care that you could see the little strings. You really buy it that she's like fumbling around on this broomstick.
And her whole thing is she's going to fight Nazis. And it's like Woody Guthrie guitar. And it said on it, this guitar fights fascists. Like, I was laughing because I'm like, this broomstick fights fascists. Like, that's what she's learning to do. And the kids immediately are like, well, we want to go with you. We want to go on this journey with you. And the whole thing is that she belongs to this school. And then the actor that we're talking about, is it David Tomlinson?
David Tomlinson, yes. Yes.
He served in
Mr.
Banks in Mary Poppins film. He, and in real life, he was belonged to the Royal Air Force. He had a tragedy that happened to him during the war, his first marriage. And then he went back to acting. And I think that must be very hard for him to do this role. It must have brought up a lot of memories.
Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine. You know, when the war happened, he already had a pretty good film career going at that point. But yes, it is terribly, terribly sad. He's such an interesting man. He was actually the subject of a one-man show before COVID. There was a show in London that they did. It was supposed to be him, and it was a one-man show and all about his really, really interesting life.
Yeah.
His father had a whole second family.
Yeah, he was a very mean man and very judgmental. And it turns out he had this whole second family going on. He didn't have a close relationship with his father.
No. And yet here's the man that you think of as like the Disney dad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He's absolutely lovable. But sadly, I mean, I don't know. Should we tell the story? Yeah. It's so sad. Okay, well, trigger warning. It has suicide in it. When he was an officer so when the war happened, you know, even though he was a movie star already, he became a pilot in the Royal Air Force. I think he was first in Canada and then he ended up in Britain. But so he married a woman in 1943, which is right when this book happens. He marries a woman who was she was an American, and she was the daughter of the vice president of New York Life Insurance. So it's that building, it's still in New York City, mm-hmm. with the gold top, the gold like pyramid top. They knocked down old Madison Square Garden to build that building.
Yep.
And her dad was the vice president. She grew up on Park Avenue. She had been married to another Royal Air Force officer who was killed in the early days of the war. And they had two boys, Michael and David. So the same name as the boy from Mary Poppins is what I'm saying. And David. So she's got these two little boys. She meets David Tomlinson. They get married. He immediately gets sent off to Britain. And she apparently is desperately trying to get permission to take the boys and go live in England so they can be closer to him. I can't even imagine what kind of a state she must have been in. Mm-hmm. And according to the, I went looking in the New York Times archives, so I read the reporting on it. So they said that she got permission for herself, but not for the kids. It was too dangerous. They were evacuating mm-hmm. children out of, you know, there were no children in London. So that, you know, she was told you can go, but you've got to leave your boys behind. And she, I guess that really just was the final straw for her. And sadly, she checked herself into the Henry Hudson Hotel, mm-hmm. Which until COVID was the Hudson Hotel, one of my favorite hotels in New York City. I said, did you ever go to the cocktail bar with that like lime green, acid green light up floor?
Yeah.
Oh, I loved that hotel. I loved that. And the restaurant, it was a Philippe Starck designed hotel. It was spectacular and it didn't survive COVID. But it had always been a hotel. It was the Henry Hudson Hotel before that. She went up to the 15th floor. It's really terrible. Please brace yourselves. If you don't want to hear about this, just skip ahead.
Hit fast forward. Yeah.
You hit fast forward. Down below, there was a one or two story building that was a tailor shop. Taylor heard these two crashes on the roof and went up and found her and the two boys. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. The boys were still in their pajamas. They think that she threw one and jumped holding the other one. Terribly, terribly, terribly sad. And, you know, David Tomlinson has just married this woman and I'm sure he must have cared very deeply about these boys. He later in his life said that, you know, he never even could bring himself to go visit, the grave. It was just too sad for him. And so, yes, he's, you know, so then he later goes on to become, you know, and again, he's got this fraught relationship with his father, mm-hmm. his own father, full of shame and scandal and fighting and he goes on to become this lovable, you know, absolutely adored by globally as the dad. You know, he is the Disney dad. And but in Mary Poppins, which was the first one that we kind of know him for, he's got a little boy named Michael who's about the same age as the stepson that he lost. I can't even imagine. And then here in this story, it's taking place during the exact mm-hmm. year that this all happened in his real life. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and it's such a, lovely performance. He's a rogue in this one. You know, he's a completely different kind of character than Mr. Banks. And yet he's different. He's still a dad. He's still a Disney dad, but he's like a roguish, you know, kind of a little bit of a scoundrel, but a really good guy at heart.
He's good at his
heart. You just love him.
He's just trying to make a living. You know, he wishes the magic were true. And he kind of thinks like, well, if I give out these ideas for the recipes and all the ideas for the different spells, maybe, you know, somebody will be able to make it work. And then I could be a part of that. They have to shut down because of the Blitz, because of London, what's going on there. So she and the kids get into the bed. And this time they're going to London to pick up a book. Specifically, they want to meet him.
They want to meet him, and he has closed the college, the quote unquote correspondence college of witchcraft, of which apparently she is the only student who he was able to scam. There was supposed to be one final big spell that she needed. Again, she's becoming a witch so that she can fight the Nazis, right? And so this is the one big thing that she's been working up to, the thing that's really going to make her useful to the war effort in her mind. And he closes she gets a letter that the college is closed. She's not getting this final spell. And so she's really steaming mad. And yeah, so they go back to London but this was odd. I thought, like, nobody seems to think it's weird that there are children there. Like in the book, everybody's like, what are these kids doing here? This is not okay.
It's a different London. And I actually saw a really interesting movie last week, Night in Soho. And it's Edgar Wright's movie, and it's about the swinging 60s of London. And there's this girl that's passionate about that time period, and she dresses like it and listens to the records. But when she goes back to London, swinging London, she realizes, oh, there's a dark underbelly going on everywhere. There's crime everywhere. There's syndicated crime and all this stuff. Anyway, London is, you know, mid to late 60s up to the early 70s was swinging London. It was fun. And so they're doing these two things. They're trying to make London like, okay, this is the place that was attacked by Nazis, but it's also filled with people who love to sing and dance and have a good time and make the times count. So there's this whole sequence called Portobello Road, which in the original versions, there was only like 2 or 3 minutes, but the versions they have on Disney now.
It was super, super long.
It's 10 minutes.
I can't even imagine what we cut out of this number because it's already quite long. I mean, I love it.
I loved it.
I love it. I think it's a great song. The song, I really love the songs in this movie. I think they're super good.
Portobello Road, Portobello Road, street where the riches of ages are stowed. Anything and everything a chap can unload is sold off the barrow in Portobello Road. You'll find what you want in the Portobello Road. Rare Annie Boster, genuine plaster.
A filigreed samovar owned by the Tsars.
A pen used by Shelley.
A new Botticelli.
The snippers that clipped old King Edward's cigars.
Made in Hong Kong. 2 bob a dozen, would you say?
Waterful crystal.
Napoleon's pistols.
Society heirlooms with genuine gems.
Rembrandt's El Greco's. Toulouse and Trecos.
Painted last week on the banks of the Thames.
Very interesting, but where do they sell books?
There's a little place around the corner.
Portobello Road,
street where the riches of ages are stowed.
Anything and everything a chap can unload is sold off the barrow in Portobello Road.
You'll meet all your chums in the Portobello Road.
Lovely to see you. Goodbye.
What I want is the other half of this book.
All in good time, my dear.
I think the Sherman Brothers got a raw deal.
Well, one of the Sherman Brothers,
it's a great song.
We should say, I think it was Robert was the one that served in World War II, was Jewish.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And he was injured in combat and was one of the first soldiers to be at Dachau and to see a concentration camp in person. And
I can't believe how much Nazis have come up during this month of Disney November that we've done. They've come up an awful lot. They, you know, it was a really cataclysmic thing that, you know, happened and touched so many lives. And I do think, you get, it's a Disneyfied, you know, World War II. But yeah, like you're saying, they have an understanding, and so it doesn't feel, it doesn't feel whitewashed. It doesn't feel
disrespectful.
No, not at all. No. They seem to understand, you know, the Nazis, we're making fun of them, but we also understand, like, they are a very real danger. Yeah. I really like the whole thing all the way around. I think the songs are super good.
Yeah, there's this long dance sequence, and it's just all these principalities of the UK, I guess you could say. There's all these different... And
yeah.
Trinidad made me very happy, because then, you know, you finally have African American people of color featured that aren't the joke. Like, they're their own people, and they are. But it's like,
yeah, we've got black and brown people.
Yeah, black and brown people.
And they're
imagine.
Not being. I mean, they're dancing, but it's not a cartoon of that. It's really nice.
It's a nice celebration of different kinds of dancing and different kinds of cultures, and saying that that's part of what London is. It's all these different
definitely
cultures, which is really fun.
It's great.
Which
it's
is fantastic. Yep. He comes back. They bring him back with her, and then the Nazis. Do you see a submarine? My brother was in the Navy, by the way, in submarines. So, but the submarines are going out the coast, and they realize, like, those are German subs.
I can never see that in a movie without, like, getting goosebumps, and I get very frightened. I get very upset. I'm very claustrophobic. There used to be a submarine ride at Disneyland. I don't know if they still have it or not, but they used to have this submarine ride. It was like a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the theme was. And my parents, I don't know what they were thinking, because they knew I was claustrophobic already, and they took me down there. And so we'd all squeeze in the submarine. It was horrifying.
Oh,
it was awful. I just think, like, if I were a soldier, you know, for whatever side, and I were stuck in that submarine, I would be so livid when you let me out. I would just be, ugh. So yeah, every time I see that, it just makes me, like, the potato peel pie one. One thing I want to mention is one of the things I really love, the whole Portobello Road sequence is my favorite. That's my favorite part of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. And the reason I love it so, apart from the music, which is great, and the dancing, which is also great, is the character actors. I love all of the, just like the, what was the other movie where they brought, like, every single British actor in California? They were like, hang on, we need you to stick around and make bed knobs and broomsticks as well.
Yes.
And they're all, I mean, I love them, and the ladies in the market stalls, and Swinburne, who's the baddie, for a second. This guy named Swinburne is played by Bruce Forsyth. Do you know who Bruce Forsyth is?
Mm-mm. No.
Bruce Forsyth, he recently passed away, not just a couple of years ago. Bruce Forsyth, I think even by then, he was quite a well-known, he's sort of like a Regis Philbin kind of a character in British culture. He was Mr. Game Show.
Oh, okay.
And he was a very well-known kind of stage MC and kind of the variety circuit. He was the guy who was the master of ceremonies and would introduce the acts and would do the banter with the audience. And he did all kinds of game shows throughout his entire career. He retired in the 90s, I think. And then he hosted a news show. He was a guest host on a news show, and he went on, he was so campy and fun. He brought up all his old, like, bits, and the audience had all these call and response things with the audience that over the years, and everybody knew what they were. And so he was doing that with the audience. And anyway, he was such a hit on that panel show appearance that he was, made the host of Strictly Come Dancing, which is the original version of Dancing with the Stars. So he was there. He was the, like, cultural icon that was the host of the host and the judge of that show. So he is like a huge cultural, you know, figure. I can't think of somebody who's quite that of that ilk, except for, like, a Regis Philbin, but he's bigger than that, I would say. And so he's playing the baddie, and he's just great. He's, like, hamming it up, and all the character actors, I just love them. I just think they're wonderful.
The lady that runs the orphanage, like, she's,
oh, I love her.
She's so sweet. I think she passed away pretty recently, mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm. They took as Margo said, the entire product, I mean, it's a little over 2 hours and they had to cut it short for the Radio City Music Hall. So I think like maybe it didn't make a lot of sense. The original,
we forgot to talk about Roddy McDowell.
Well, because Roddy McDowell's in this movie for like 10 minutes. Like there was
like, here I am. And then he's like, here I am again.
Because you see Roddy McDowell, you're like, oh, this is going to be fun because he's always good at what he does.
He's great.
He always brings something. But there's a whole thing with it opens with the older soldiers coming into town singing their song, The Old Home Guard.
Yes. So you're watching it in the 1970s audience, and you're like, how are these old men gonna, the Nazis are coming. Didn't anybody tell you? These are Nazis. How are grandpa and his old buddies from the pub gonna defend you from the Nazis?
That's always this fear. Yeah. Basically, Angela Lansbury, Eglantine Price, she's going to fight the Nazis, and the kids are like, well, how do we, she and the Mr. Brown, he goes back to London, and she's going to take care of the kids for a while. And I think he wanted her to go with him. I think there's some kind of thing where he leaves.
There's like a will they, won't they get together, but we're British, so we can't ever say that we feel things for each other.
We can't hug. We can't do anything.
No.
And the kids want it to happen. The kids are like, yeah, let's all be a family. We want him to be our dad. And he's sleeping at the train station. And as he's sleeping at the train station in the middle of the night, the Nazis come into town. And it's scary. And they take over her house and they put her into the museum. And then the kids are like, well, what if you cast a, because they have all these.
They have apparently an extremely extensive collection of medieval armor.
Thank you. And it was for humans and for horses.
Hundreds. Like, hundreds and hundreds.
Not a dent in them. I mean, they're ready to, and the flags and the horns and she's, so they're like, well, maybe you can get them going. She says, well, how do I do that? And so they bring out a pair of shoes and she says this spell and the shoes start tapping. And she's like, okay, maybe I could do that with all this army gear, all this, you know. And so she does, and it works. And they start coming to life. And so they start fighting the Nazis, and the Nazis are shooting, and there's invisible people. And as soon as the Nazis figure out, like, oh, these must be ghosts or something, they just turn tail and run, I guess, back to the submarine. There's a few that are stubborn, you know, try to stab them and stuff. And I'm always like, shoot the Nazis. I'm like yelling at the screen, like, blow them up. Like, come on, they're Nazis.
Come on already.
Yeah, let's do this already. But they turn tail and run. And so basically she saved the town, this little town off the coast. And he's going to stick around and hang out with them. And they're going to be together. And it's all about fighting fascism. And we didn't even mention that there's a whole scene, and this is why when we were talking about how trippy it is, it goes to cartoon land, and they land in
there's
the bottom
a whole
of
animated,
the scene.
Yeah. Because why? Because we have a song we didn't use during Mary Poppins.
Exactly.
It was about being on the bottom of the sea. It was going to be animated, but we could put them there in this movie. Sure, why not?
So the bed goes to the floor, and then David Tomlinson and Angela Lansbury sing this song called The Beautiful Briny, which is like very catchy and upbeat.
It is. It's Disney.
It's Disney.
How pleasant bobbing along. Bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea. What a chance to get a better peep at the plants and creatures of the deep. We glide far below the rolling tide. Serene through the bubbly blue and green. It's lovely bobbing along on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea.
What if the octopus, the flounder, and the cod think we're rather odd?
It's fun to promenade, bobbing along, singing a song on the bottom of the beautiful briny sea.
Look!
win the dance contest and they go up the stairs because the bed is on a hook, and a bear greets them. And they've been amorphosized. What's the word?
Anthropomorphized.
We have
animals that act like humans.
Right.
All kinds of animals.
And just basic humans. There's no racial stuff going on. But there's a Leo the lion. He's in charge. And on the lion, he wears a medallion that has the code for one of the spells.
The spell that she's looking for that she's going to use to defeat the Nazis. Yes.
Yeah. So David Tomlinson is recruited to be a referee for a football match.
Which they insist on calling soccer. Why are they calling it soccer? You're British.
It's the American version. Okay. That's what we get. And then but he wins, and then the lion likes him so much, he gives him the medallion, and they're like, okay, thanks a lot, dude. And then they take off and they go back to London. And that's the trippy part of it. And this movie, I super love this movie. I mean, it was re-released in 1979. That's must have been when I saw it. When my mom took us, I think that had to be, but it's been released.
Yeah, I think I saw it in the movie theater. So I mean, it would have been like, yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's when I saw it.
It's trippy. Just like the other, like they said, like there's psychedelics kind of going on there. There's this great dance sequence with a lot of modern dance moves. They're kind of like, they're mixing up things. It gets mixed reviews. And one of them is Roger Ebert, who says, you can't use an actual Nazi as a bad guy for a kid. They don't understand it.
But I feel like this is after Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah.
Even I knew when I seen it in the movie theater when it came out in 1979, I had seen Hogan's Heroes. I knew what Nazis were.
Yeah.
My grandparents had served during the war. By that point in the culture, kids know what that is. You know, I didn't agree with a lot of the criticism of it that I saw. And I keep wondering, like, first of all, it seemed clear to me that they hadn't read the books.
Right.
That seemed super clear. And secondly, like, what, I don't understand what they were expecting. Like, what were they hoping that the story would be about? It's called Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Like, what was it? What do you want?
It takes place during World War II.
You get a whole soccer match.
Yeah.
With humans and animals. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Can we not just watch it and enjoy it? The soccer match, I think, is really good. It's very well animated. And again, it's, you know, when we talked about Sleeping Beauty, these kind of growing pains that Disney went through with animation, with their old style versus their new style. And this one is firmly in the new style. And I think it works.
Yeah. I think the story works. I think it's really enjoyable. If you have Disney Plus, definitely check it out. It's there. I can't decide which I like better, the book or the movie, actually. I'm having so much fun with it.
I know. I really loved the book. I recommend reading the book. If you have kids, again, who are like, I would say 8 to 11, mm-hmm. It's totally appropriate. I think it's a great way to talk to kids about that era. It's very enjoyable, and yet it's fun. It has a lot of humor. It's lovely. It's a really, really, really great couple of books. But then I really loved this movie. My only nitpicky thing about it was we blew a lot of money on the effects of the flying bed and the animation animals in that. And so that when you get to the end with the Nazis fighting the empty works of armor, it's a little bit puppety.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit, we're very clearly on the Disney soundstage with plastic plants.
Yes.
You know, I feel like we could have been outside. You could have gone to Malibu. We could have done a little more here. But I still loved it. It's great.
It's an underrated classic. It really is.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's a tie. They're both excellent. And I really loved them. I super, super loved watching that this week. It was great. It's just fun to escape to a world where Nazis are bad. For a while. That's kind of fun.
And swing in London during the Blitz. Some people went dancing, by the way. They did.
They did. Yeah. I mean, you would. What else are you going to do?
You got to let it out. Yeah.
Seriously. It's just great. It's just fun. And I just really... I'm no more going to stand for people pooping on this movie.
No, you set them right.
We are now,
yes,
embarking on. Here we go. Holiday for the rest of the year. So what do we have up first?
I think it'll be The Bishop's Wife. It's available.
Are we going to do with the Whitney Houston one or we're going to do the original one?
Either one. You decide.
I've never read it. Have you read it before?
No.
Let's do the original.
Okay, but we'll mention.
And we'll look at Whitney Houston.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to get. As we said, we cover songs, we cover plays, magazine articles, like anything that we can get online or whatever. We might be covering Grandma Gets Run Over by a Reindeer because they actually made a movie out of it.
I haven't heard that song yet. I'm going to see how long I can go without hearing it. Mariah, I've heard Mariah like 24 times already, yes. And it's not even December 1st. It's not even Thanksgiving.
No, it's not even Thanksgiving when we're recording this. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody, by the way.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving. Happy, you know, however you decide to celebrate this holiday.
If you have suggestions, please let us know for holidays. Yeah, and definitely look at the Patreon page. Like I said, some of that stuff is free, but you can at least see like what we've covered in the past. So yeah, we've covered just about everything, but there's still some out there.
I just want to recommend something my brother-in-law sent me about a week ago. Especially for those of you who maybe don't live in the United States and are baffled by Thanksgiving, there is a really cool, I'll see if I can find it and link it in the Facebook group, but there is a very interesting historically accurate look at the first Thanksgiving, the tribe that still exists today or the nation that still exists today, the indigenous nation and the Wampanoag and it was in the Washington Post. I'll see if I can find it and I'll see if I can. But anyway, you can just search the Washington Post first Thanksgiving. It's really a good piece of journalism. It's very well done.
I will definitely check that out. So please follow us on all the social media things. We really appreciate that. Also, please remember to send us your suggestions. Just remember, once again, it has to be something easy to get and something that is streaming. And Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com. And all of my social media callouts are at She's Not Your Mama. And where can they find you?
You can find me at Brooklyn Fit Chick, mostly for Twitter and Instagram. My site is brooklynfitchick.com. Thank you all very much. Happy holidays. We're excited to get going with it.
I'm a little nervous. I'm not going to lie. I'm a little scared.
We'll be back soon with a new episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Book vs. Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags Lady Pod Squad and Potter and Family. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to Patreon, and look for Book vs. Movie podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book vs. Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book vs. Movie. Spell all those words out. If you'd like to send us an email, it's Book vs. Movie Podcast. Spell that all out at gmail.com. You can follow Margot D. at Brooklyn Fit Chick on social media and Margot P. at She's Nacho Mama. Let us strike a bargain. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.
Give your gift the needed lift.
Oh?
You possess the know-how, and I command the show-how. Oh, how successful you could be with me.
I'm afraid we're wasting valuable time.
What's your name?
Miss Price.
No, your first name, my dear.
Eglantine.
Oh, how you'll shine. Your lot and my lot have got to combine. Eglantine, hark to the stars. Destiny calls us, the future is ours. As the shine sells the boot and the blossoms the fruit, all you need to succeed in your plan he is the proper.